You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of April 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, a U-turn in Israel on the future of 30,000 African migrants that entered the country illegally. My guests today, Rosemary Hollis and Matthew Green, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including an anti-fake news bill from Malaysia. And with the beginning of the Commonwealth Games, we ask, how relevant is it as an institution? All that plus a new Saudi law that punishes if you snoop your spouse's phone. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. So, a warm welcome to today's edition of Midori House. My guests are Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University of London, and Matthew Green, journalist and author, has worked in West Africa and a number of other places as well. Welcome both to the programme. Good to have you with us. And let's start with a potential agreement between Israel and Western nations concerning the fate of 30,000 African migrants who entered Israel illegally has been cancelled after being agreed with the United Nations. According to the original plan, some Western countries, such as Germany, Italy and Canada, would resettle over 16,000 migrants and Israel would give an equal number temporary residency. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says now he will consider all options to remove the infiltrators. Rosemary, why has the deal been cancelled by Israel, do we think? And why indeed has Netanyahu switched to language infiltrators? Quite provocative.
Well, indeed. Actually, this is part of the Israeli discourse at the moment. They are calling the Palestinians who are demonstrating on the border, the Gaza Strip border with Israel, they're calling them infiltrators. It's depicting migrants, would-be refugees and asylum seekers, as some kind of sinister force that infiltrates an otherwise healthy and secure society. And it's reminiscent of the language being used in a number of countries in Europe now. Viktor Orban, for example, in Hungary, this notion that they can't have any migrants, especially not Muslim migrants, for fear that they will contaminate an otherwise pure white Christian heritage, society, values, traditions, and so on. And that, I think, is the instinct of Netanyahu's cabinet that they can't be doing with non-Jewish migrants who have different cultures, who will not blend in to the project that they see Israel as being. Whereas, on the other hand, you have other Israelis who've been making a terrific fuss over the Passover period in particular, that Israel, of all countries, should not be turning away refugees who are fleeing oppression. And in the midst of all of this, it appeared that Netanyahu had got himself quite a clever deal, thanks to the auspices of the UNHCR. It was a bit astonishing to me, hearing about it yesterday, that the Italians and Germans were saying that they would take some of these to relieve the Israelis. The Canadians were supposed to take some too. However, we never got to investigate that. That wasn't confirmed from Italy or Germany before Netanyahu was convinced by members of his cabinet to do a U-turn.
Matthew, that's an interesting point, isn't it? But Rosemary mentions there this sort of instinctive response from many governments, politicians and pundits on this issue of migration. And in some respects, Netanyahu has, in a way, returned to type a little bit with some of this sort of more bellicose rhetoric, the more sort of nationalistic sort of tone of it. Why do you think he's got himself tied in knots? Because at one level, as Rosemary said quite astutely there, it seemed a relatively good deal, actually, on a number of levels.
Well, quite. I mean, he's obviously under pressure from hardliners, I guess, in his own party. But it's interesting to remember the history as well. going back 30 years or so, Israel was organising airlifts of Ethiopian Jews out of Sudan during the famine in the Horn of Africa. Although I actually remember doing a story in Ethiopia about the Ethiopian Jews, the Falashas as they're called. It turns out they're probably not really Jews at all, but it kind of suited everyone's purposes at the time to turn a blind eye to the historical facts and kind of usher them onto Hercules transport planes in the dead of night. And thousands of them were airlifted in this incredibly dramatic operation organized by Israeli intelligence, Mossad and the CIA and all kinds of shady characters. And they brought thousands of Ethiopians into Israel in those years. So it's rather sad in a way to see that the pendulum has swung in completely the opposite direction.
Well, no, it was...
Except that the asylum seekers that they're talking about now have not actually declared themselves to be Jewish.
True, yes.
Which is a germane point. but I guess it resonates me to that point you made, though, before, and there was echoes of the US experience with migrants as well, and this idea that this was a nation built on immigration. How does the narrative play domestically, do you think, within Israeli politics? Because we know there's a strong nationalist agenda. It's quite right wing, of course. But there is this sort of wider sense of an obligation. And you, of course, you're going back to the origin stories of the modern state. It's pregnant with meaning. Is there a large demographic in Israel who says, hey, look, come on, this is what we should be doing. We must be demonstrating our democracy and our democratic values to the world.
There isn't. I mean, I think the case of the Falashas is interesting. And I have in Israel come across people who have, on reflection, wondered how well this community would ever integrate with other Israelis. But then, you know, if you put aside the Palestinian issue, the Israelis themselves are really quite divided, and they describe each other in ethnic and derivative terms. Some Jews who'd emigrated to Israel years ago now that I interviewed about why they left Britain, they said, well, you know what you find? You leave Britain because you're always a Jewish minority in Britain, and you get to Israel and you discover that you're a British minority in Israel. And so there's quite a lot of consciousness. There's also the Mizrahim versus the Ashkenazi. There's in this mix, the common denominator for the melting pot has been Jewish identity, and it is not common for Israelis to welcome non-Jews in the same way as they have welcomed Jews. There are exceptions, but the big elephant in the room here as to how they deal with African migrants, be they Muslim or Christian, but certainly not Jewish, then if it's okay for them to come and be integrated in Israel, why is it not okay to have family reunification of some of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip?
Hugely complex. And to these hapless migrants, and so often, Matthew, we have to end up having this conversation, where are they going to go? Because these people are being shunted around. There's so much pressure. Everywhere they seemingly encounter this narrative, which is increasingly unpleasant in tone. We know it's informed by nationalists, by populists, whether it's in Europe or in these other sort of constituencies. Where will they turn next?
Question: wasn't Israel offering some of them a lump sum of cash and a plane ticket back to Eritrea as well?
Well, there's some very sort of curious deals, and they're often just sort of left at the airport, and actually all is not quite what it seems. But is that what it's going to take? Payoffs to complicit governments overseas?
I wonder.
It wasn't payment to the governments.
No, to the individuals.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Eritrea discovered that, or so I've been reading, Eritrea discovered that were they not to accept the payment and the plane ticket, they would be forced to go to Eritrea, and there was no money in it for Eritrea, so far as I know.
Well, no, and they were also seemingly, or a number, anecdotally at least, were seemingly relieved of said cash payments rather quickly when they arrived wherever they were to go. Is this part of the problem, I guess, also here, Matthew, that, you know, migrants, if we look at the rhetoric from the Oval Office or, you know, Viktor Orban, Rosemary mentioned, wherever you look in the world, it is the easy get away with it, please your base at home narrative to say they're the problem, keep them out.
And it's getting harder and harder for them to move now in the way that they would have done a few years ago, because even across the Sahel, countries like Niger, Mali and so on are cracking down on the movement of migrants towards Libya and obviously the North African coast en route to Europe. I was reading as well that there's obviously now a fence between Egypt and Israel, which has stemmed the flow of migrants, African migrants trying to get into Israel. So, yeah, the options are closing down. And Eritrea, of course, is a totalitarian dictatorship. I mean, it's been compared to the North Korea of Africa. And a lot of these young men are fleeing conscription into the armed forces. So maybe that's where they'll ultimately end up.
Rosemary, it concerns me deeply that we're probably politically generations away from addressing this. You know, it's an easy stick with which to beat people. It's an easy way for politicians, maybe under pressure domestically, to find an easy group to blame. Is that a generational problem? I mean, even in advanced Western democracies, it seems to be increasingly the norm to talk in these terms. What addresses that?
Well, talking to some of the humanitarian organisations, ones like Save the Children, who would be very concerned about children being trafficked if they're not being smuggled. In other words, you pay somebody to get you onto a boat and then hope that the Italian Navy will rescue you when the boat gets into trouble. And if that is stopped by Europeans who don't want more migrants, then you go underground, or the operation that gets you to Europe goes underground. And instead of you paying the smuggler, the trafficker is paid by the recipient of these slave children. Or sex slaves or whatever. And in the face of this, you're absolutely right. Governments and politicians are running scared. Now, the charities that are concerned about the human rights and safety of the people trafficked or smuggled or whatever are saying that part of the problem today is that the numbers are just so much greater. Mm. So there's always been migration. Migration is the norm. I mean, we all migrated continent to continent hundreds of years at a time. The demographics would change. And it's a fallacy in this essentially racist debate to say there's something purely European or purely American, for goodness sake. So it's identity politics reduced to racism in the face of impossible numbers. And I think you could genuinely argue in the European societies that the societal order could very well break down if there was a massive flood of migrants who couldn't be absorbed readily. And this, of course, has turned politics in Germany. Angela Merkel said, yes, we can. But it's taken a huge effort and lots of goodwill on the part of Germans to help migrants who are not going to necessarily feel welcome, who are going to be traumatized and alienated, to make a life for themselves. And it takes a generation for the next, the children, to blend in. But then you've got the children, the second and third generation of migrants from North Africa to what was their colonial power, France, seeking identity in an anti-continental French way. This is the issue of us today in Europe trying to understand what it means to be British as opposed to French as opposed to Hungarian. And can we have societies for all the people in the society, all the citizens are equal, or do we as human beings need a national identity that has some kind of powerful mystical and emotional meaning for us?
No skirting the big questions here on Midori House today, but let's switch our sights from Europe to Malaysia now, where the debate surrounding one of the defining issues of our times, one of the other defining issues, is hotting up. Fake news, a term first popularised by, who was it again? President Trump, I think. Word of the year in 2017, according to Collins Dictionary. Today, an accusation flung by politicians on the left and the right. But what is and isn't fake is often in the eye of the beholder. The only consensus seems to be that fake news threatens our democracy. Malaysia's bidding to become the first country in the world to take steps to an outright ban on fake news. A bill is expected to be passed in the Senate. Critics suggest, perhaps with justification, that the sentencing guidelines up to 6 years in prison could be an even greater attack on democracy than the phenomenon that it's setting out to curtail. I guess, Matthew, one of the problems here is defining what fake news actually is, and I don't think the Malaysian government have a better steer on that than anyone else.
Well, no, and it does seem that they consider fake news to be anything touching on the $4 billion corruption scandal, which is entangling senior members of the regime. I mean, Malaysia really is a notorious kleptocracy now, and I think a lot of people don't realise quite how far the country has slid in that direction. And to me, this crackdown on so-called fake news is transparent authoritarian power grab, basically. We've got elections coming up, possibly in a couple of weeks' time. You've got this corruption scandal ongoing, and the country has got very little space for any sort of democratic dissent at all. So I think this is a very disturbing signal.
Rosemary, what about the wider point, I guess, which is that it might be helpful diagnostically to try and at least decide what fake news is, whether it's in Malaysia. And I think Matthew, I'd probably go along with Matthew's reading of the bigger picture there. Do we need to understand, try and define what fake news is to try and address its menace?
You're only menaced by it, though, it would seem, if it is critical of what you stand for or what you're trying to do. I mean, this seems to be how Donald Trump defines fake news. It's anything that he doesn't like. And we were told at the time, during his election campaign and just after, and over the whole Brexit thing, that when you're faced with somebody with a compelling stand, dismissing the facts or attempts to put the facts as fake news, it really does you no good to try and re-argue the facts, because that's not what's going on. However, I personally can't do without some sort of sense of forensic science which can establish how many people died by counting the number of skeletons, establish how they died. I mean, let's take this example of the poisoning of the former Russian agent and the Russian accusation today, or suggestion, inference, that it would have been something that the British Secret Service could have done. It would serve a purpose for them. And how come in Salisbury the hospital had the antidote to this particular nerve agent? And they are unsettling questions.
Matthew? Well,
there's two types of fake news, though, isn't there? There's the use of the term fake news by Trump to essentially denigrate negative press coverage or anything he doesn't agree with. But there's also real fake news of the not fake fake news, which is genuinely fabricated news reports. You know, Hillary Clinton is a Satanist and has organised the murder of children and FBI agents, etc., etc., which is very consciously disseminated for a political, to serve a political agenda.
And I guess this is the point. That can be what we seemingly are presented with, cases where its effect is quite insidious. And because of the way that social media works and so on.
Well, particularly in Southeast Asia, because we've seen in Myanmar with the persecution of the Rohingya, enormous use of what's it called? They're not the real fake news.
Real fake news, yeah.
To whip up ethno-nationalist hatred against this minority in Rakhine State, leading to one of the world's biggest humanitarian disasters. And Facebook was very clearly mobilised, very cynically, in that context. So it is a real issue. But the problem is that, you know, look at somewhere like Malaysia, I think Philippines, Indonesia, other countries are also taking this line. It serves the authoritarians to be labelling any, to use fake news as an excuse to kind of squeeze the democratic space even further.
I wonder if it helps in defining it to... I take your point that there's real fake news.
Yes.
And there's just things that you don't like, and you, in the Malaysian case, you could label that fake news and then prosecute the perpetrator. But I wonder if conspiracy theory is attached to the real
another
fake.
Subcategory of real, real fake news. News. Yes,
I we think need some kind of flow chart to,
yes,
to describe us. I just wonder though, who's the arbiters? Because it struck me, even Rosemary, when you said, "Look, I like there's no substitute for a forensic approach." You know, looking at where did this incident happen? I'm seeing a journalist with notebook and pen in hand going and watching and making notes.
And a detective.
Well, and a detective. But this is my point. You know, part of it, I guess, is the trust that the reader, viewer, listener, or whoever still has in their, you know, establishment figures, whether it's the law enforcement or police or a supranational organisation or journalists. It's part of the problem that once people lose trust in their institutions, even in more enlightened, we'd like to think, Western liberal democracies, this becomes easier to do. If you want to disseminate this sort of news, it's easier because people distrust the traditional arbiters of what's real fake news or not.
Well, I suppose I would refer to scientific forensic science, as I say. And as I would say to students, there are some things that you can establish. You can establish what time of day this incident occurred, which year, which month, which year, which country, how many people were injured, how many people were killed. When somebody tries to impute meaning to that, because one of the dead bodies in the pileup of cars turns out to be the former prime minister of somewhere, that's when all these stories get woven as to the significance of this incident and the possibility that it was deliberately planned or deliberately brought about by this incident. And so I think there is only so much you can establish. And I think in countries where you're dealing with a dictatorship, you're crying out for something that you can rely on as fact, but and therefore that you know that the authorities are getting away with stuff that is unfair and inappropriate and so on. You know, I'm actually thinking of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and he wrote a book, The Autumn of the Patriarch, and you didn't know what was real and you didn't know what was fantasy, and he was trying to put the reader through the experience of not knowing which is which. Because the Americans had come and chopped up the country and chopped up the sea and taken it away, and it had all gone, and the dictator had so many doubles. Were you seeing one of his doubles? Was he dead already? So when he dies, nobody knows if he's really dead. And you can't, you go mad.
Mm. This way madness lies. Yet another sobering thought, Matthew. Let's continue our global odyssey on this programme. Tomorrow marks the beginning of the 21st Commonwealth Games, to be held on the Gold Coast in Australia. More than 6,600 athletes from over 70 Commonwealth nations. It seems, potentially, a timely example of countries coming together when so much of what we hear, indeed we've been discussing, has been about divisiveness. But how effective are the Games, or, for that matter, the actual Commonwealth, at truly bringing people together? Matthew Green, are you waiting with your programme of events before you?
I didn't actually know it was happening until you just told me.
That answers the question. Why not, then? Shouldn't we be getting interested and getting excited about an event that brings people from all corners of the globe together?
Maybe if we're rabid Brexiteers, we should. We think that the Commonwealth is going to somehow replace the European Union as our vehicle for projecting global influence after we leave the EU. But, I mean, the Commonwealth's obviously a group of former British colonies, basically, isn't it? And I wonder how much real capacity it has to leverage any sort of effective pressure. I'm scouring my mind for examples. I mean, you hear about Commonwealth boycotts, don't you, occasionally, of certain countries that have
had
coups and things.
Would anyone notice, I guess?
Yeah, I just wonder whether they have the institutional machinery to do anything really beyond organising games and other sorts of occasional jamborees. I might be missing something.
And often at great cost to the
local
community.
Yeah, they do have summits, don't they? Not every year, but every couple of years, I think. They do have these big Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which the Queen attends.
The CHOGM.
Yes, the CHOGM.
I believe it's fondly referred to. Rosemary, what do you think that this should be more honestly referred to still as the British Empire Games? Of course, that's what it was. That's what it was formerly. Would there be a certain candour to respect if it was so named?
Well, I looked up the Commonwealth Secretariat and their agenda, and it's a lot of development issues. It's about capacity building in the poorer Commonwealth countries. There's a sense there that the richer Commonwealth countries don't actually need Britain anymore and might be quite interested in seeing if there's some kind of better trade deal they could do on one or other commodity. But the poorer ones, I don't see them as able to deliver to Britain. I see them as having a sense that Britain should be taking a lead on helping them develop in the ways that they most need, whether they've suffered a hurricane or another catastrophe, or it's a question of their capacity. And so I'm saying it's more about environmental issues. They're going to suffer much more from environmental change, climate change. It's about youth issues. And improving the job prospects of the youth. And I think there's a terrible pattern in Britain when they discuss the former empire and the opportunities that it presents, is to see this as a captive market, which it used to be during imperial days. And that is
often literally, yeah.
Exactly. And they really shouldn't be foisting British goods on countries. That's the last thing they need.
Well, Peter Beattie, and this picks up on the point you started by raising, Matthew. Peter Beattie, who's the chairman of the Gold Coast Games, has told the New York Times that Brexit has made the Commonwealth more relevant, not less. Now, he didn't explicitly say for Britain as a potential trading platform. But does that just show how misguided those that endorse these sorts of
Well, it may have made it sort of 2.5% more relevant. So in a sense, yeah, it's more relevant. But is it? I still don't think it's going to provide much in the way of influence for Britain going forward.
And Rosemary, I guess, do we read anything into the fact that for the next iteration, which I think in 2022, one imagines, there was only Birmingham and Liverpool left in the mix. Birmingham had to step in when someone else dropped out to host the next Commonwealth Games, that is. Does that speak volumes? That it was a short list of only two? I guess not that much interest in hosting the Games?
No, indeed. I mean, now I'm kind of left speechless by that. But and on this Brexit issue, there seemed to be some debate within the Commonwealth as to how to get over the shock. There was a spokesman for the Commonwealth Secretariat saying that it's time to get past the shock that was experienced across the Commonwealth when the British opted out of the European Union. And they don't know whether it's a good thing for them and a good thing for and a moment of opportunity or not.
Yet more sobering thoughts. Let's get some more before the end of the programme. If you catch a significant other scrolling through your texts, that's pretty bad. But is it a reason to call the police? Yesterday, Saudi Arabia's Ministry of Culture unveiled a new anti-cybercrime law with a clause designed to criminalise exactly that heinous infraction. Matthew Green, should the state be interfering in people's personal lives to this degree, and are you a snooper?
I think it's high time that we established our own vice, virtue and morality police in this country for reporting precisely that kind of offence. I'd be straight on the phone if I found my significant other looking at my text messages. I'd be dialing 999.
And that's more appropriate than meting out some sort of primitive justice yourself. I don't know.
Well, no, I prefer to leave it to the professionals. Obviously, in Saudi Arabia, they do know how to do a good stoning, don't they, or beheading. So I'm sure we'd come up with an appropriate solution.
And Rosemary, I guess there's a sort of an irony here. It's such a conservative country, and yet very keen users of social media, new technology. How do we square that circle of this sort of leaning to modern developments?
Immediately and yet suspicious. And I looked at different coverage of this. And for example, I got Al Arabiya and how they're describing it. And that suggests to me that it's us Westerners who've alighted on husbands wishing to stop their wives interfering with whatever kind of relationships they're conducting on their mobile phone. And it's more about trying to stop crimes of hacking and protect individuals from things like illegal access into a website to alter the design of the site, damage it, modify it, occupy its address, invade privacy, and infringe on private life by misusing mobile phones.
There you go. So they're helping us out. They've got our best interests at heart.
They've got the state's interests at heart.
Saudi Arabia is entering a new era of westernisation under Mohammed bin Salman, right? So
it's all going to change. Don't hold your breath, Matthew. We'll just leave it. That's Rosemary Hollis and Matthew Green, our guests today on Midori House. The programme was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Augustin McIllary, and researched by Megan Atkinson. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. My thanks to them all. Do join us at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.